You are listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly episode about role-playing games, the people who play them, the gamers who game them. My name is Ran Aviram.
My name is Uri Lifshitz, and today we have two special guests. Guests, introduce yourselves.
Kia ora, my name is Lauren McManaman. I am the co-author of Girl Underground, and I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Woohoo!
Hi, I am Jesse Ross. I am the other co-designer of Girl Underground, and I'm super excited to be here as well, and super excited to talk to you both, so thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you for coming. I'm guessing the question on about half of our listeners' mind is, what is Girl Underground? Because that's the common thread between these guests. And Girl Underground is an amazing role-playing game about a curious girl in a wondrous world. If you want a word image, think about Alice in Wonderland. Think about Spirited Away. These are the kind of things we're talking about. And this role-playing game allow you to kind of fall into that narrative and embrace it and take yourself
down the rabbit hole, Uri. Fall down the rabbit hole.
Oh my God, I can't believe I have not used that.
Sure.
Allow you to go down the rabbit hole and experience that process of growing up, wild journey with amazing beasts and friends. And it is a wonderfully designed role-playing game. I played it a few weeks back, and the first thing that came to my mind was, oh my God, I need to play that again. But the second thing was, I need to get these guys over because I want to ask them a ton of questions.
I did not play it. I read it, and I think it's one of the best design games I've ever read. And so we would like to talk with you about lots and lots of things, I think. But maybe we'll begin with something else. What is your experience in game design? What other sort of games have you designed in the past? What did you created before that we should know about?
Yeah, so I have been working on a few things. Girl Underground was kind of my first big published project, but I've previously been writing and doing illustrations for the Codex zine by the Gauntlet, where I've done a couple smaller games, and probably the other game that I'm most well known for at this point is Trophy, which is my horror fantasy game of doomed treasure hunters going into a forest that doesn't want them there. Not at all like Girl Underground.
And Lauren?
Yes. I have a habit of like making a lot of games about making out and romance when not writing Girl Underground. So I think I'm most well known for my hack of Final Girl, which if you don't know Final Girl, it's a slasher horror game where you kill off people, and I was like, oh, you could totally do this but about dating people, like The Bachelor. So I did Final Girl, a game of love where you have like a bachelor or bachelorette or bachelor them, and you have contestants go on dates with them, and each one gets kicked off the show until there's one left. So that I'm working on doing that as a standalone release, since I did that for Gauntlet Codex. And oh, and then Sherlock Holmes, Hot Guys Making Out, which is, again, a reskin of Hot Guys Making
Out. Hot Guys Making Out.
For Sherlock Holmes and Watson, where you have a dashing mystery that you solve and also make out with Sherlock or Watson.
And that's going to be out when? I'm just writing dates on my calendar.
That is
no reason. Moving on.
That is currently in Codex Love 2,
Lies.
I believe. It's Codex Lies. Yes. Yes, the Hot Guys Making Out Sherlock Holmes is available in Codex Lies, which I believe you can find on DriveThruRPG.
It's very good.
You've both mentioned the Gauntlet. How about providing a bit of explanation on what it is for the people who don't know of this community?
Yeah, well, sure. It's where Jesse and I met, which I'm very grateful for. It's a community of mostly gamers and some designers who just get together and play some fun games. Along with if you subscribe to them on the Patreon, you get access to their monthly zine codex, which has supplements, standalone games in it. There's some super cool lops that are coming out right now. And yeah, it's always like you never know what you're going to get inside of it. But it's always a fun time.
It's a very accepting, very welcoming online community. They have, I think, thegauntlet.com, probably.
Gauntlet-rpg.com.
They are available online. You can probably find them easily in Google. They have a Discord server, but we are not here to talk about them.
No, no, no. We're here to talk about you guys and specifically about Girl Underground. And why don't you tell us where the idea of actually playing this sort of journey came to you, and how did you went about to actually execute that?
So as mentioned, Laura and I met on the Gauntlet and became very fast friends. And I had been sort of stewing over this idea of a game in my head for a while. So I'm a dad of two girls, and I'm a feminist, and I'm super into the stories that we don't always tell, particularly around women and young girls. And I'd been super deep into Powered by the Apocalypse design. And one of the things that system is known for is genre emulation. So taking in some common stories and the tropes around those stories and building a game that helps you reproduce those types of stories. One of the things that I didn't find happening in Powered by the Apocalypse games, or in that genre of games, and in gaming more broadly, is something that would tell stories like, as we've already mentioned, The Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland and Spirited Away and The Labyrinth. There are all these stories about young girls going on adventures, learning who they are, changing their beliefs, and then coming back to the real world. And I was really excited to try to do something in that world, and reached out to Lauren because I knew she also had a love for those types of stories. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
So I have a few questions about this genre. What is it? How would you call it? I think you refer to it as a girl or female or young female portal fantasy in the book itself. Do you have any other name for it? Because I do recognize its existence. Everything that you've just said, all of these narratives obviously belong to the same genre, Labyrinth and Wizard of Oz. What is it? What's the name of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. One thing that comes to mind is when Jesse approached me about writing Girl Underground, he actually pointed out a website, I think it's called girlunderground.com or something like that, that had sort of used that word to define the genre in that capacity, which I thought was a super neat way to sort of encapsulate it. But yeah, I think like it's interesting that I don't have a good shorthand for it. It's like, yeah, female portal fantasy, sort of is like the genre, but it doesn't do a good job of bringing it into like a snappy.
I'm very happy with accepting Girl Underground as the name for it because it sounds pretty good.
Yeah, there's a writer and also game designer named Kate Winter who saw all of these stories, and she was the one who sort of originated that idea of Girls Underground, and her website is girls-underground.com. And she has a huge listing of all of these stories that fit into this trope. And I know when I saw that name, I was like, oh, that's a perfect name. That's such a good name for a game. And so, yeah, funnily enough, like we have the hero's journey and we have all these other classic tropes, but, you know, sort of true to form, there's no name for these stories about young girls, despite how frequently they appear in literature.
So I can talk about this for hours, but in order for us to continue on, I just want one final thing regarding this genre. First of all, is there any story that you would say belongs to this genre despite appearances? That is something that would not immediately come to mind, like, oh, Wizard of Oz, of course, it's a Girl Underground story. And why is the Neverending Story not in this genre? Because I was thinking about maybe male counterparts, and the only thing that came to mind is the Neverending Story, and I don't think it belongs to the genre, despite appearances. I think it's more about a single boy discovering himself, which happens a lot in the Girl Underground genre, but but there's also the existence of Manels, the girl against the world, the girl against society, which I think is what the genre is actually about. And did I just answer the question for you?
I think you did.
Yes. Perfectly.
Yeah, we had this whole debate before we started recording the show about what does and doesn't fit into this genre. And it could be the fact that the antagonist is the world and the conventions in it rather than yourself and what you need to overcome inside yourself. But again, Iran, we're talking instead of letting the guest talk. So Jesse and Lauren, please.
It's so fascinating to me because when I think of texts that fit in the genre, I'm like, oh yeah, like I know, like, yeah, The Labyrinth, Spirited Away, that like sort of female protagonist going into a different world, to the point where I can't think immediately of anything that jumps out is like, oh, that's in this genre, but you wouldn't think it at first for exactly the reasons you pointed out. Like, there's something so different between portal fantasy with like young male protagonists and portal fantasy with young female protagonists. And I'm blanking on like the really clever intellectual discourse theory behind it. Mm-hmm. there is definitely something unique about sort of female portal fantasy compared to other similar genres with protagonists of different genders.
So, Jesse, I want to ask you a more technical question because you've mentioned it a moment ago when you talk about it. Now, this game is, as you mentioned, powered by the Apocalypse hack. Why go with that and not create your own system or work within the boundaries of another gaming mechanic? Can you elaborate more on that?
Sure. So one of the things that I really love about Powered by the Apocalypse games generally is that they are built around these idea of playbooks, right? So you have, rather than a sort of generic character sheet that everyone builds their characters off of, you have these kind of classic character archetypes. And that's why, as I mentioned, it's pretty good for genre emulation, because you're taking all of these common threads and ideas that you see in the genre and distilling it down into certain types of characters. Powered by the Apocalypse 2 also has some really simple mechanics. And one of the things that we wanted to do with this game was have very few rules up front so that it made it really easy for people to get into the story and start playing right away. In fact, the opening of the game, the way you kind of start the game, is character creation, but it is play at the same time. And so when you do that, it allows you to just have more time to play and more time to tell the story, which was really important to me and Lauren.
I want to give out two things that I find very interesting about the game for our listeners that have not read it, that they should know. First of all, unlike other Powered by the Apocalypse game, there are no basic moves. There are only playbooks. That is, you get a sheet of paper, and when you do something that corresponds to something written on your sheet of paper, you activate the rules and you roll two dice and you add them together. And that's it. There are no stats. There are only these moves and what happens out of them. There are some other things happening around on the table itself, manners and beliefs that can interact with this. But generally speaking, not only is this simple and straightforward and interesting because each playbook is very different, but also it's supposed to only take about 4 hours to play each game, something like that. And it's we both, Uri and I, really want to talk about that aspect of the game, which is very interesting, how you manage to construct
a timeline,
time slots, yeah, the timeline of how to play the game, but we'll get to it in the end, which is also where you've placed this construction in the book itself.
Basically, the party is playing the girl, which is lost somewhere underground being a general term for any magical realm that the girl is currently in. The girl also being a general term for any protagonist, male or female, that's currently in that journey. And the other players are playing the friends, the companions, which can be, imagine everyone in The Wizard of Oz and you get the picture, the Tin Man, the Lion, etc., etc., the archetypes of these kind of creatures. Now, what I found really interesting was that the role of the girl is actually transferable. One of the players play the girl, and when he or she are done with it, they can simply activate one of the girl's moves, which is the merry-go-round, and basically saying, I don't want to be the girl anymore, you be the girl, I'm back to playing my companion. So this mechanic of switching protagonists is something that I haven't seen anywhere else, and I would like to hear more about that.
We'll be honest, sincerely, we sort of borrowed a bit of inspiration from Bluebeard's Bride, that where the players share this protagonist. And when conceptualizing this game, I remember Jesse and I going back and forth a bit about, oh, should there be like a girl playbook that one person plays throughout, or is that going to give them too much spotlight, or like sort of give them too much like fun to have and that kind of thing, while everyone else is kind of playing a supporting character. So we were like, oh, yeah, what if like this protagonist sort of like was shared by everyone, and that way everyone gets to explore what it's like to be in her position, but then also what it's like to be someone interacting with her, which I think for me is such a fundamental part of understanding like growing up, as you sort of transform from a child into an adult. So having that sort of different perspective of inside versus outside was really important. Thing we were then a bit worried about was, how are people going to play this girl consistently? Like, how are they going to know her voice and be able to like really get into her character and get into her skin? Which is why the character creation is such a collaborative process. We give it like where the group will together decide like her hair color, what she sounds like, or sorry, not her hair color, her hairstyle, like what she sounds like, what she wants to be when she grows up, and really spend like a good amount of time understanding her and how she speaks and what she's like and what she is afraid of and what she aspires to be and what she finds fun, what she finds annoying.
I think it works. The fact that you create the girl as a group really allows everyone to play her convincingly. And even more importantly, give everyone the option of focusing on different aspects. And from my single game experience, people usually remember that specific detail which they contributed to, so they can always play on that. They always have something to relate them to the girl.
One thing that that we were a little worried about is the companion playbooks are super fun and super colorful. And we knew that people would be excited to play them, but we also wanted to make sure that we really centered this on the girl and her story and her journey. And so making sure that everyone was invested in the character of the girl was super important, and that they were excited to play her and felt really felt her feelings and felt her journey. And by having her be a shared character, it made the story about the girl and gave everyone the focus that this was a story about the girl.
And I'm so excited about talking about this game. Another thing that is like a GM tip, right, is like all of the answers that you give as the girl are then reincorporated into the world. So it's like if she's afraid of silence, it's like, oh, then I know for sure she's gonna go to a place in the underground that's like full of silence. Or if she's afraid of like busyness and activity, it's like, oh, you know, there's going to be like something in there for her to overcome that involves noise and bustle.
It's very easy to run. I think that's what struck me the most, because as a GM, you get so much input that, like you said, it's really, okay, she's afraid of X. Oh, right. The first location is going to be all about X. Duh. And you have all these tools for instant interaction and instant feedback built into the game design.
And probably the thing that I like most is that you actually provide the location. It's not like, oh, well, where should we go next? Instead, you have 12 locations, suggestions for locations, and each of them are characters, the troubles that await there, the sort of props and questions that can be asked in there, how to use the location. A single page per location, easily enough for 45 minutes of role-playing that place and establishing all of the principles, all of the GM principles that you want to establish in that location. And also your principles, which I really like. A principle is a thing that happened in every Powered by the Apocalypse game, but I think that in a lot of the cases, they are given in a theoretical sense, what sort of things you should aspire to, while you give very specific, concrete advice that is, it's very good. It's exactly the sort of thing that Uri and I really like to do on this podcast. We really try to give the very specific points. So when you say, for example, lead the way through the underground, you give the guide, which is the GM, precise advice on how to now sit down and think of what is the next location, how to give a link to that location, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not left as the guide thinking that I was just given a trove of information that I am just not experienced enough to understand and be able to do, but instead instructions. And I can follow instructions.
One, to that point about advice, one of the things that we also wanted to make sure we incorporated was advice for how to, as the guide, how to treat all of the different characters in the game. So from the companions to the girl herself, and wanted to make sure that we gave very concrete instructions about kind of what the different characters represented and how, what kind of positions to put them in to take advantage of their unique abilities.
Which, and I know for me, this came from a place of like, when we were first playtesting Girl Underground, before we had all these locations, I was like terrified of running it. I was like, oh my God, this is scary. Like, this is such a specific genre and the tale told has such a structure to it. And having to manage like that phasing narratively, plus like bringing in all the companions, I was like having a panic attack like before running it. So I was like, oh, that's a problem. Which I think is partially why, like, this advice is like, this is what you do. Here's some instructions on running it. Particularly around, like, the sort of story of meeting the companions one at a time is so true of, like, Alice in Wonderland and Wizard of Oz, that it was important to sort of bake that into the advice to say, no, like, take time, spend 10 minutes with each character and each companion and the girl and have that scene where they meet, because you really can't skip over that, but you might if like you were picking it up and going, oh, we don't want to get like straight to the action. So I think that's also where that came from.
It's nice because you can see that because you felt the actual pain of trying to run something like that off the cuff, then you really took the time to solidify an advice that would lead any potential GM straight to the point.
Yeah, and I feel like I've come a long way too because I ran this recently a couple of times at a con. And I was thinking back to old me that was like, oh my God, like I can't run my own game. To to like at that con, I was like, oh yeah, I'll put this location here. Oh, and then I'll, if we have time, I'll put that one there, merge those two together, and now I've got a story. So I can say it works for me.
You also ran it recently in one shot.
Yes, I did. Yes, yeah.
I will give a link in the show notes if any of you listeners want to listen to a game of Girl Underground being played, ran by Lauren and on the famous One Shot Network. You should definitely do that. A link in the show notes, or just search for One Shot Girl Underground.
If you need some convincing, it was very emotional. There was a lot of like, I was in that room watching everyone go like, oh, and like have well up a bit here and there. So there was a lot of like intense emotions going on at that table.
Yeah, that's I think that's the trademark of this game. It deals with a lot of issues that I feel pretty much everyone has encountered at one time or not in their youth, which bring me to my next point. This game, as we've just mentioned, deals with a lot of potentially problematic issues like genders and expectations and you against the world and what you're allowed and not allowed to do and what society forces upon you and etc. And in contrast to this, this game has one of the best intros regarding expectations, gender, and safety, which is the title of this section in the game. And again, this is one of the best intros I've encountered to this specific topics. Can you elaborate on that and specifically about the safety tools that you have here? The safety tool I'm referring to is the putting four pieces of paper on the table. One that says pause, one that says rewind, one that says fast forward, and one that says frame by frame. And allowing players to simply tell the table and the guide how problematic some scenes are for them. For example, if I, as a player, press the pause sign, it means we should take a moment, or if I take the rewind, we should move back and avoid keep going down that specific rabbit hole. So if you can elaborate on that, because this is amazing, because this is like two short pages which really encapsulate a lot about how to set expectations and how to actually discuss gender and safety on the table in a thoughtful and clear and concise manner. So I would love to hear more about that.
Oh, when I begin, sorry, I consent and expectations and safety is like my number one topic. So I'll try not to ramble too much. But in terms of the safety tool we used, Jesse and I really thought hard about what would be useful in this game as a safety tool, because I see, well, it was important for me to give the players the opportunity to explore those really pointy issues, but sometimes stuff might come up around it that you're not prepared for, and a script change in this case by Brebo Sheldon felt like a good fit, because you can sort of you pause if you want to sort of take a moment to breathe or discuss something. You can then like rewind back to a point before the thing happened and then like find another way around. Or you can fast forward if you're like, cool, this happens, but let's not dwell on it too much. And having that ability to take control over how you want to navigate it to such like detail was super important. And then of like frame by frame, where you can really slow down and take the game beat by beat to make sure you get through a scene safely and fun, even if the topic is a bit sad or scary or uncomfortable. And then the gender stuff, actually, I came from my dear sibling who is non-binary, and they had some really good advice on how to frame that paragraph there to like explore gender, since sorry, I'm going on a bit here. Like, in a way, part of this game was like a love letter to myself growing up as like this confused, like, queer person. And I was like, well, if I had this game at that time, like, maybe I would have had a better opportunity to understand myself or understand like the world around me and that kind of thing. And being able to give people the tools to likewise explore that conversation, again, was very important to me. So making sure that advice there at the top was like up front and center, this is how you should like approach gender, explore it. It's there to sort of play around with and put on and that kind of thing. It was key to my heart.
I just want to chime in too and give Lauren extra kudos for the way that consent was interwoven throughout the game. So we've mentioned already the moves that the different characters have in the game, and they're all framed in the form of questions, and sometimes those questions will have implications for another player's character. And we wanted to make sure that whenever that happened, that it was done, that anything that would impact them was done with their enthusiastic consent. And so that level of thoughtfulness that Lauren brought to the game was so crucial to just making it a good experience that everyone at the table can enjoy, even if they hit on some hard topics.
Yeah, thank you. I totally like blanked on that bit, but yeah, I had a lot of fun with Jesse going through and figuring out like how to frame each move, since I think we both approached it with this idea that a 6- doesn't have to be like a failure that is on the GM to necessarily like make a move with like your typical PBTA. It was more important to like look at the consequences and say, who's best placed to talk to what's going on here? Is it affecting the girl? Is it affecting a companion? Is it affecting like the world around everyone? And I think approaching consequences and weirdness and like 6- who's best placed to speak to this in mind.
You've done something that I really like, and you've avoided the usual terminology of addressing 6- as a miss and 7+ as a hit. Instead, you said results of 6 or less lead to weirdness, danger, or a setback. Results of 7 or higher lead to success. So you did say the word success. But generally speaking, you avoid looking at it in terms of a binary
success
hit
and
miss.
Failure.
Yes. Yes. Which is great because this is exactly what PBTA meant to do from the moment it burst into the world.
Before we move on, I just want to take a moment and say thank you so much for opening up and sharing that with us and our listeners. It's wonderful to see people take something from themselves and put it into their creations in any field, but especially in role-playing games.
That brings me to, I think, the thing that I enjoy most about the entire game, and that's the concept of manners. Because while PBTA...
You would.
While PBTA is great in, as you said, emulating genres, manners is where you actually, I think, transform Girl Underground from a game to art, if I may say so myself.
thank you.
And you may.
Manners are... codified social agreements and constructs that are told to the girl are a required part of her behavior. There's a list of them, a huge list, but you're all supposed to choose 8 for each game. And for example, there are things like young ladies must never brag or show off, young ladies must never cheat, young ladies must always be quiet and patient. Everything that you imagined Alice in Wonderland probably heard while she grew up. And then broke as she, manner by manner, she went through them and broke them apart as she went through the world of Wonderland. And that's the whole point of the genre. That's the thing. That's what we're here to do. So you've captured it and you called it manners, which is amazing terminology. I'm very much into terminology and I really like this choice. And you made it, of course, into an important part of the game by giving it mechanic. When you cross off a manner by a move, the girl has a move to do so, it becomes a belief, which is then a new thing. You literally turn the card around, the card, index card on which the manner is written, and you write a new sort of belief that she has about her place in the world. And then she can use these beliefs to power up her abilities, and that's the only way you can get any bonuses to her role in the game, when she plays on her beliefs. And that's something that's supposed to happen more and more toward the end of the game, where she has more beliefs, and then the final fight, I'm doing air quotes, the final confrontation. She uses many of her beliefs to fight off the evil or whatever and get back to her world, probably.
Don't we all?
Where, how did you think of this whole system? Where did it come from?
Oh my gosh. Do you remember, Jesse?
That's what I was going to say. I know we started, the game started with the girl having 3 stats, which were courage, compassion, and cleverness, sort of based on the lion, the scarecrow, and the Tin Woodman. Nice. And it was kind of fun and we loved it. And it was a darling for a while that we ultimately had to kill. And this was the replacement for it. And it is infinitely better. And I'm so happy that we ended up going this direction because, I mean, part of it came from, I think, just the whole idea of like, what if the girl didn't mind her manners? Like, what does that mean? And the other piece that we knew we wanted to do is we wanted to make sure that we could set up this ever building story where we know the girl wins, gets home in the end. Like, we know that that's going to happen. So mechanically, how do we sort of set that up so that that is the case? And this manners to belief system was what kind of ultimately landed out of that. And the other thing too is just a simple reflection on what these stories are about and what the process of growing up is about, especially as a young woman, is that you are told there are all these certain ways that you're supposed to be and not supposed to be. And though men suffer from similar sorts of issues, the system is much more codified and I think is very easy to see in the world that women have to deal with, and wanted to make sure that we could flip that on its head and give the players an opportunity to push against those and break those and say who this girl believes herself to be through the end of it. through this experience.
Yeah, I feel like I remember having a conversation with my mom and my sibling about this as well. So I feel like I should shout them out, but the details are lost to time. But I remember like having that really neat experience of like sitting down with my mom and my sibling and going, dang, like I'm having a conversation about game design with like these two really important people in my life.
Awesome.
And thank you to my family for any inspiration that I derive from those talks.
So I guess you could say that there was this manner that every RPG character gotta have at least 3 stats and up, and you change it into a belief that it's just the decision you make in game that really yeah. should infect your character.
Right.
Dang, like it was interesting writing some of these too, because like as you said, sometimes bits of us sneak into our design. And I remember like when I being a kid, I didn't even know where I got this from, but like the idea that girls couldn't be funny. And like feeling really disappointed because I was like, dang, I like being funny and I want to be a stand-up comedian when I grow up. So what a shame. And like really taking that to heart. And I think that's one that I like live with for a long time. But then also sort of breaking manners around, like I played a lot of soccer and football like during lunchtime. And got judged for that and thinking like, screw this. I like playing sports. So like, yeah, it was a little hard look at myself writing some of these.
Let me tell you how I know that these are actually great fit for this list, because when I ran the game, I simply gave the list to my players and I said, okay, pick the one that really resonates with you or that have happened to you. And at the end of that, like 1 minute that I gave them to choose, I looked at what they marked and I said, no, you have to pick 8. Only 8. You're going to have to get rid of all the others. So it resonated with a lot of people.
Oh, I'm glad. that's what they're there to do.
I'm glad and also sad.
Yeah, yes. Don't be glad. It means we live in a terrible world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, the last thing that I really enjoy about the game is a title you call The Game, which is a checklist of things to do when you run through the game, which is just the structured format of how to play Girl Underground with timestamps. So I'll go through it very quickly so people will know why I'm excited. First, set expectations and tone 15 minutes of like the session zero of this 4-hour game we're going to play. Explanation of safety tools, creation of the girl, finding the door is the process of after you decided who the girl is, how she enters the world, and you collectively write the beliefs and the game almost literally begins. Then everyone select companions. Then you take a break, which is an amazing thing. All of them have some time to write some thing down and maybe take something to drink. And the guide now picks locations and decides on what the game is going to be about, what is going to actually happen. And again, they can follow a very simple list of steps to pick the right locations, their final destination, all sorts of things that they can work with. And then there's the introduction of companion and quests. Then you have an adventure, which is about 30 minutes per location, and that's what most people would call the game. And then there's the final confrontation and the journey home. Finally, companion epilogues, because of course you should have epilogues, the girl epilogues, reflection, and debrief if you have some time. And this is something that should be part of every one-shot game ever. And every game, I think every, let's call it indie game, that wants to capture a very specific experience, very specific feeling, should probably also explain to me how I literally sit down and play it around the table, because many of them are not just, yeah, here are characters, here's the world, here's the module, go ahead, when there's combat, you roll initiative. Many of them are should be constructed like this, because you go through a pretty structured process as you, from the moment you begin until the moment you end. And what made you decide to write it down up to how many minutes each of these is supposed to take?
So first of all, we knew we needed to do something like this because you're telling a very specific type of story. And the structure, though it's powered by the apocalypse, is a little novel in certain ways, right? You're swapping characters, there are locations, there's this girl character that everyone makes together. And we wanted to make sure that the way that we were running the game was codified so that other people could get the same experience that we were getting and that our players were getting out of it. And to figure out the times, Lauren and I just went back through, because we play a lot of games online, we would go back through our older games and say, oh, that took about a half an hour, or we spent 15 minutes on that, and really just captured what we were doing. We went through multiple sessions and tracked it, and that was about how long things were taking. And so we're like, okay, that seems reasonable. Let's just let people know how long it should take to make a character. Let's let people know how long they should spend on each part of the game so that they, again, have that same experience and so they know what to expect. And again, these are guidelines. Not everyone will follow these. Not everyone should. You might want to play a one shot, air quotes, over two sessions, or you might want to expand it into a longer campaign. And I think the game should allow for that, but at least providing some sort of a framework, some sort of an expectation for what you're getting into, I think is super important. And I'm really glad we did it. And I know that other players have been super happy to have it.
Well, yeah, because I think like the pick up and play aspect of Girl Underground was super important for Jesse and I, since we wanted it to be a low prep thing you could bring to a con or like bring to your local game evening and be like, hey, I have this cool game, do you know, play it without having to like do a lot of prep. Yeah, like having that structure to facilitate the kind of game you want to play was, yeah.
This is by far one of the easiest to run games I've ever ran. And I've been through some weird shit, let me tell you this. But your answer here was amazing, because my next question is literally, can you talk about your test play process? And you kind of mentioned that by playing a lot of online game, which you can then actually save and see what went wrong or what went right.
Lauren and I started this game on opposite ends of the planet. Yes. She was in Australia and I'm in the central part of the US in Minnesota. And we would do a lot of like kind of note swapping throughout the day, but then we would have times where Lauren would stay up super late and I would get up super early, and we would just have chats, you know, at crazy hours of the day, and actually do little sample playthroughs with each other of like, okay, well, what if you were the character and you did this? And then what if this happened? And then what if this happened? And we started our playtest with that, with just, well, what would you want to have happen? How would you see that playing out? What would feel good at the table? Did a lot of that pretty early on. And then we started bringing it to the Gauntlet and to the calendar there, and opening it up to people for playtests and make sure we were recording everything. We went through a lot of iterations and a lot of different variations. And one of the things that was great about that was, because it was recorded and because there were two of us, we could go back and listen to each other's runs of the game and say, oh, what if you had done this instead? Or what did you like about that part of it? Or, oh, that was really cool how you did that part of the game. I'm going to start doing that now when I run the game. Mm. And it gave us an opportunity to bounce ideas off of each other and get to that point where, though we have somewhat different GM styles, every GM who runs this game is going to have their own way of doing it. And so how do we capture all those best practices and codify it in this list? It was a wonderful process and truly a blessing to see Lauren run the game when I wasn't there, just so I could absorb her great ways of GMing.
Oh, likewise.
One of the ways in which I'm evaluating any rule book that I read is asking myself how much of what I just read was redundant for me. Because as someone who has been role-playing for over 35 years now and been GMing for, God, I don't know how many of those. You know, I sometimes skip all the GM tips, etc., etc., etc. And I can honestly say that even though that Girl Underground is under 50 pages, all in all, I think it has like 0% that I could have skipped over and simply Except for, you know, the what you need to play, maybe, because I figured most of that on my own.
No, I've noticed this too. It's very
concise.
Concise. And it's all just things that you need in order to play and nothing beyond that. And that's really great.
That was part of that was a limitation of the format. We produced this as a part of Kickstarter's Zine Quest campaign. And so we had to produce it in a short booklet. And we knew we had a limited number of pages, and we wanted to make sure those pages really counted. So we had to make sure that we just condensed down as much as possible and provided players with and GMs with exactly what they needed to run it.
Which I think is also why I greatly appreciate our partnership, because there was a lot of checking each other on, do we need this? Oh no, yeah, we need that. We have to have that in. Or like, do we really need this? Like, no, I guess we can cut that.
We both can be a little wordy, and we both are good editors, I think.
Yes.
So it was helpful to have each other to bounce off of.
Definitely.
Wow. I just imagine crossing the stream of cross-editing. You write something, and then Lauren said, take this off, and then she writes something, you take that off!
This is pretty much it in a nutshell.
Yeah.
It was really good.
So, what's next for you? Was this your first collaboration and we're going to see some more in the future? What's the next thing for us to expect?
I mean, if I'm lucky, I'll get to collaborate on things with Lauren again.
Totally.
Because she's such a great partner. So this was our first project together. I hope there are many more.
Mm-hmm.
We do as well. We do as well.
I know that we have other plans for Girl Underground. This is not the end of this game. This is just the first taste of it.
Good.
We already have more companions in the works. We already have a giant list of other locations that we want to introduce to the game. So all of that is yet to come.
Excellent.
There's definitely more Girl Underground in the future.
I haven't even told JC this yet, but I was lying in bed late last night and I was like, what if, like, you did a bunch of space-themed locations and, like, you did Girl Underground in space? So, like, and if my brain has not stopped thinking about Girl Underground, so there will for sure be more coming.
There are stories about portal fantasy sort of in space. There is such a thing. Nothing comes to mind, but I'm going to assume that there's something.
Yeah, there's lots of really fun themes you can explore, like the existential crisis of an endless void and that kind of thing. Like, which I know for sure I was preoccupied with when I was 10.
There's also this genre of Beyond the Garden Wall, which I don't think is Girl Underground. It's Siblings Beyond the Wall. And it explores family and maybe maturity, and I'm not sure exactly what, but I don't know as of yet of any game that emulates that thing, and I'm curious to see something going that
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there are definitely possibilities for hacks of this game, or, you know, other derivatives of the game. I know we have a few plans in the works for how to adapt the game for younger players, for example.
Ooh.
That's been a hotly requested feature.
Ooh, yeah,
and for doing one-on-one games, exactly. One GM and one player.
Yummy.
Focused on like a mother-daughter or parent-child kind of situation?
Not necessarily. No, focused on basically having just one player play the girl the whole time and no other players. So if you wanted to play this with your partner or your child, you could do that.
For me, I was talking a lot about my personal life. Like, my dad was the unlucky parent who, like, had to play make-believe Wizard of Oz, where he was all the characters. Mm. And I was the scrappy protagonist with Toto the dog. Someone mentioned like a one-on-one or a duet game. I was like, oh yeah, of course. Like, that was all I did as a child, was make my dad be a fictional dog. And on our adventures through what Wizard of Oz.
Let's gamify that.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, guys, it's time to summarize. Usually we have quite extended summaries, but here I think it's really simple. There is a game, it's called Girl Underground. It was designed by Lauren and Jesse, and you pretty much have to buy it. Because... because it's an awesome game, and also because it teaches you so much as a GM, as a guide, as so many different ways to listen or to give voice to your players. And I think, again, following the fact that I've been GMing for so many years, I think this game gave me and could give potentially to any other role player a lot of new tools and new ways of reaching new emotional depth within your game.
I think we are missing something important as well from the player side. This game is an excellent exercise for players who are not yet used to taking responsibility on the fun around the table. In such things as, well, we all create together the girl. We share responsibility about her. Each of us, when we play as one of the companions, have this list at the bottom of the page, which is amazing, which says, when you portray the X, try to do the following. And it gives you five things that you should try to do. And that is excellent. It's excellent. It's a good advice. And it teaches... hopefully, players to look at a grander scope than just their character sheet and what I want to do. It's also what is good for the story, what is good for the GM currently. How can I play with the GM to create something greater than just what I'm currently wishing to do or whatever?
This genre is so excellent for bringing in players and exposing them to their own contributions to like truly collaborative storytelling, because one, it's a genre that everyone is familiar with. Everyone knows the stories of The Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland. Those are just like in the cultural ether, right? So everyone's already familiar with the types of stories that Girl Underground tells. And two, it's fantasy. So really everything goes. And if you have a good idea, if you have an idea, it's easy enough to just share it and then share it to the table and allow everyone to riff off of it and build off of it without, oh, that doesn't make sense, or that's not historically accurate, or whatever. It truly is a wonderful genre for collaboration.
Is there any final thing you want to plug that you haven't already?
Oh, can I plug myself?
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
So, outside of game design, I'm also a full-time tabletop role-playing game editor, and I've had the privilege of working on... I did all the editing for A Good Society, which I think we mentioned earlier, and lots of Fraser Simon's work on The Veil and Hack the Planet, and if you need a TTRPG editor, I am available. my website is thestraykiwi.com, which is, as it sounds, like T-H-E-S-T... RayKiwi.com. And all my work is there as well, all my design stuff that I've got going on. I think that's my main big plug, is I'm available for all your editing needs, whether it's stylistic, proofing, whatever. It's all good.
Lauren obviously comes highly recommended. She's a wonderful partner who will give you good design ideas if you want them, and a wonderful copy editor, and all around great human being. So
thank you.
Please hire her.
Awesome. There will be a link in the show notes as well in our guest page on the blog website.
So I just wanted to share the kind of parent website for Girl Underground, which is hedgemazepress.com. You can find Girl Underground there. You can also find more about Girl Underground at girlunderground.org, where you can get little sneak peeks of the various playbooks and how the game works. Please check it out.
And if you decide to buy it, do buy it through HedgeMagePress, because then they get more money than if you buy it through DriveThru RPG. Your choice, your decision.
Also, you should get the physical version of the game, because it really is, I think, a beautiful object. It has gold staples.
Mm-hmm.
Can you confirm, Uri?
Gold staples? Where did I miss something?
No, on the corner. The staples are golden.
Oh.
Sure.
Awesome. Lauren and Jesse, thank you very much for coming to this interview, and thank you a lot more for creating this amazing game.
Oh, thank you so much for having us on. It's a delight talking about this game. And you two are lovely.
Oh, do continue.
If you want to listen to any more of what's happening here, go to dwarfcast.net, and if you are interested in approaching us with whatever it is that is on your mind, do so at show@dwarfcast.net. And if you want to listen to us talking a bit about things that happened to us in our role-playing lives, just wait for another moment.
Do nothing.
Moment.
Wait
no,
for it. Yeah,
second.
Wait for it.
It's
just in a moment.
Right
in a moment.
Now.
Oh,
here it is, here
woo-hoo!
This world is carried on the shoulders of the war.
This is the part of the show in which we talk about role-playing games in our personal lives. So usually Uri and I talk about whatever happened to us last week. When we have guests, we more than welcome them to talk about whatever it is that they currently find interesting or exciting or whatever they just played. Never mind. Whatever it is that they choose to talk about. I have nothing to talk about. Haven't
what?
Played. I'm unplayable currently. So instead, Uri, give us a short thing.
A short thing, no problem. This week I have played a game. It is not a board game. It is not a role-playing game. It is actually a card game. And I have played the new edition of Free Dragon Ante, my all-time favorite card game in the world. For those of you who don't understand the connection, Free Dragon's Ante is a card game by Rob Hainsu. And it is set within the realm of D&D. Meaning this is officially, by Wizard of the Coast, the game that your characters play between adventures. It is an amazing game. I have talked about it and fanned over it many times in this podcast and before. I've actually met Rob Hainsel, and then I hugged him and I said, "Oh my God, you changed my life!" And he said, "Who are you? Get away from me, stranger!" But the point is, it's an amazing card game, and the Legendary Edition is so much better than the previous editions. It like has everything that me and my friends have always thought about and discuss for days about ruling, etc. was all there, and it's simply a much, much better version than the previous two versions that this game had. So I highly recommend it.
Excellent. I will never play it. Lauren, what about you?
Well, I funnily enough just got done playing a bunch of Girl Underground at a con, so that's on the top of my brain if I can indulge further. I played a couple of games, but one that really stuck with me was a beautiful story about a gender questioning child who was a bit angry, had very short hair like clipped grass, and spoke with a gravelly voice, and got to bear witness to their story as they went through this wonderful, fantastical land to defeat a dragon. And the dragon, as a final confrontation, was their best friend from home that also had anger problems and was being bullied by this world because everyone said they're mean and awful and they eat people and they're terrible. And the dragon was like, "How can I go outside of this cave? Like, if everyone is so mean to me and hates me," and like, it was just that beautiful moment where conflict doesn't have to be violent, and like the final confrontation doesn't have to be take down a big bad. This final confrontation was like accepting yourself and being true about like who you are on the inside, and being kind and accepting to other people, and then the boy at that point jumped on the dragon's back and they flew home.
Nice.
After telling the dragon that they're kind and nice and, you know, like it's okay that they have feelings and that kind of thing. And yeah, that was that. I was like tearing up playing that game because it spoke a lot to my like personal life growing up. And I remember thinking like, don't cry, like you can't cry, you're the guide, like you've got to hold it in until like the end. But that was a really special. A special game that I played recently.
Very good. Jesse?
I am deep in the world-building mode right now. for my next Kickstarter, which is going to be for Trophy, my aforementioned horror fantasy game. Hopefully coming next February. We'll see. I just ran a contest with Jason Cordova of the Gauntlet, where we had people create their own incursions, which are adventures for the game, and just read through 50 of them that were submitted, which was incredible. And so many talented people and so many good ideas. I'm just really excited about what's happening with this game, and other people are clearly very excited about it and want to help build the world of Trophy. So keep an eye out for that. You can look up trophyrpg.com if you want to learn more about the game. But yeah, that's what I've been busy working on, is helping bring that to life.
Excellent. Uri, do you have anything else final to add?
No. It is customary for us to end the show with everyone saying goodbye to our listeners in their own native tongue, whatever that may be. So, on the count of 3, 2, 1, later!
Catch you, listeners!
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by Attribution Non-Commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Duo, and you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.